You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The national numbers are, the international numbers are in. Oxfam has released a report. The 85 richest people on Earth have the same amount of wealth as the bottom 50% of all humans on the planet. The top 1% of the population owns 46% of the planet's wealth. That's pretty astounding. The bottom half of the population has 0.7% of the world's wealth. Now, that's worldwide. In the United States, just 13 Americans made more from their investments last year than the entire food stamp budget. That's $80 billion, enough for a year of food stamps for almost 50 million people. The richest 400 people took home $300 billion in 2013, approximately the entire social safety net for the United States. And this was just the income of the richest 400 Americans. Equal to the 400 people. You could put them in a high school gymnasium, took income equal to that, the entire social safety net of the United States. That would be SNAP, women, infants, and children, WIC, child nutrition, earned income tax credit, supplemental security income, temporary TANF, temporary assistance for needy families, and housing support. And the richest 1,200 families are estimated to have each made $40 million in the past year. Now, these startling wealth inequalities we saw in the United States, we saw them rise in 1921, rather, when the Republican Harding was elected on the platform of dropping the top tax rate. He dropped it from 91% to 25%. We saw an explosion of wealth among the very rich, which led to the great crash of 1929. And then we entered a fairly egalitarian period. The top income tax rate went back up to 91%. CEOs only to earn 30 times what their workers did for the next 50 years. Until Reagan came along and dropped that top tax rate down again. And we've seen over 32 years now this explosion in inequality. Why? Well, in part because rich people can buy politicians, and then those politicians do the bidding of the rich people. Is this really how we want our country run? Dr. Alex McFarland is with us, conservative speaker, writer, and advocate for Christian apologetics, director of the Center for Christian Worldviews and Apologetics at North Greenville University. Alex McFarland, mcfarland.com is the website. Alex, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom. It's great to be back with you.
So, I understand that you think this is fine. Do I have that right?
Well, no. I mean, no human who's got a heart and a soul is fine when people are hungry and people have needs and those needs aren't being met. I mean, the question, though, is what is the best, most humanitarian and, I would say, godly way to meet those needs? In a new book that I just released last week, I talk about the fact that not all approaches to compassion are the same. In the opening remarks, you said that rich people can buy votes and can buy politicians, and I would say that liberal politicians can buy votes. The great disparity
by offering income, welfare programs.
Yeah, and offering things like cell phones and medical care.
Isn't that how democracy is supposed to work? That when the people want you to do something and you do it, they reelect you?
No, I mean, ostensibly,
democracy is not supposed to work that way.
Yeah, Benjamin Franklin said this, that the best way of doing good to the poor is not making them easy in poverty, but by leading or driving them out of poverty.
Yeah, but Franklin never ran for public office.
But he was one of our founders and definitely one of the strongest philosophical leaders at the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah, you'll find, if you read Franklin's biography, you'll find his positions on poverty were all over the map over about a 40-50-year period of his adult life. When he went to England and he saw how their welfare system worked there, he was horrified. He came back here and he actually helped start one of the first. He was the one who lobbied George Washington to start the poorhouse in Washington, D.C. He started the first public library in Philadelphia. You know, I mean, he was all over the map.
But neither Franklin nor any of the founders, I think, would be okay with what we've seen come out of the war on poverty and the Great Society the last 50 years to create this entitlement.
Oh, I think Hamilton would be absolutely in favor of it. Well, actually, Hamilton might not. In any case, should we be, I mean, you know, those founders also thought that slavery was fine. I mean, if you want to bind us to the standards of 1787, I think that we can make a strong argument against that.
They were already talking about how to get rid of slavery at that point. And so I don't think you can make a case for the founding fathers would having been in support of where we are with big government.
Okay, let's go.
Intruding farther and farther into the lives of people. I mean, what we have now is exactly...
It is not intruding into your life to give you a Social Security payment that you paid into.
Well, the philosophy now that's leading the approach to social justice, quote-unquote, is really the redistribution of wealth. And the assumption that the success of one comes at the necessary expense of another.
Well, and to a large extent, it is a zero-sum game. We've seen this now for 32 years with 32 years of Reaganomics. What we've seen is as the rich get wildly richer, working people have seen their salaries collapse and the poor are getting poorer.
A rising tide lifts all boats.
Nonsense. A rising tide lifts all boats if you have a boat.
If you have a boat. And to be
and a lot of people in America don't have a boat.
That's why you have benevolent organizations like the church. That's why you have great benevolent organizations like Samaritan's Purse and the rest.
The amount of money that was spent in the United States last year feeding people by private charitable organizations, according to the Internal Revenue Service, is about $5 billion. The Republicans just cut $4 billion out of food stamps.
Well, let me say this. What our programs, the food stamp programs and the programs of the last 50 years, they not only discount the vicissitudes of human nature, that anytime you've got free things and you've got the government as the babysitter that people are going to get things for free, it becomes a disincentive to work. There's ample opportunity for abuse, which we've seen.
I think this is such a canard, this idea that for some reason poor people are sitting around, you know, with their feet up eating bonbons, watching TV, and loving the fact that they're living in poverty. I just can't imagine that you've actually been out in the streets and worked with or seen or known people who are living in genuine poverty. That is, if you offered those folks a job, they would take it in a second.
And by God's grace, I have been in a lot of those situations. The two things that we need to point out is that the welfare state and the big government culture that we live in right now that gives people things and with no accountability and no.
There's absolute accountability. You have to be a good citizen of this country.
Listen to this. But the idea, though, that things like health care and things like a cell phone and things like tuition to go to college are just due me by the government simply because I exist, that's absolutely counter to what our Constitution and our national DNA
are. I absolutely disagree. I think those are parts of the general welfare. And I think that they're also wise investments, maybe not the cell phone, but that was Ronald Reagan's program to give, you know, the elderly, you know, a phone that they could dial 911 if they were so poor they couldn't afford a phone. But I know it's turned into somehow Obama's phones, but it was Reagan's program.
And that's what government always does. Government grows and grows, and it becomes this monster.
Healthcare and education are fundamental. You know, healthcare should be a right for all Americans. I'm astounded that a Christian would say we shouldn't be healing the sick in this country.
An ultimate moral code and an ultimate moral good.
Apparently your moral code is don't heal the sick, right?
Not necessarily.
Okay, just don't do it with government money.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Alex McFarland, alexmcfarland.com, the website. Thank you, Alex. We'll be back. Sorry for getting heated there. I just, at a certain point, it's like, you're really going to scapegoat poor people? I mean, that's really what you want to do? You really want to say it's fine that we have people becoming billionaires and multi-billionaires and multi-multi-billionaires? And what on God's green earth can you possibly do that's worth $1 billion a year in income? What can any one person do that actually has that value for that labor? and then say, oh, but poor people, you know, they're freeloaders or they're leeches or something, and liberal politicians are buying votes. But conservative politicians, when they take money from a defense contractor and then give them a big defense contract, they're not buying votes. It's like my head is exploding. Anyhow, Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Yeah, you're
talk me off the ledge here, Corky.
Huh?
Talk me off the ledge.
All right, I'm probably going to get up there with you.
Okay.
You know, these guys here, their claim to fame is, I got it, I earned it. No, we gave it to you. Remember in World War II when we sent our family and loved ones to fight Hitler to keep free? We did that for you.
Yeah.
So that you wouldn't be under a repression. We did that. Not you rich guys who sit there in your suits behind a desk saying, here, pick up your guns and go fight them. They're trying to get me.
Well, this is an argument that's being made on behalf of Christianity. I mean, Alex McFarlane is making an argument that the Christian argument is not to have government causing people to be dependent upon government by giving them welfare.
Well, you got to stop giving me your God, because I don't believe. I'm sorry. I don't believe.
Okay.
I believe I'm in this here alone. The people I grew up with and I love. And I don't want to hear about your God said you should do this.
Yeah.
But the right thing to do is, we're behind an anthill. You know, I sit there in the summer and I studied an anthill.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter whether the ant was injured or not. When it came dinner time, they all sat down and ate.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't you didn't bring in enough food today, so you're not going to eat.
Right.
Now, they all sat down and ate. And we're even lower than ants, these people. And the unions, this happened in 35. The same thing that's happening today. The gap between the have and the have-nots was so far and wide that Roosevelt had to say, look, these people are going to have a right to organize for better wages. And that's what stopped the revolution that was going to begin.
Yeah,
you can see it today. It's that you got fast food workers trying to organize, and you got corporations telling them they can't. Now, I want to ask you one more question while I got your ear.
We've got about 20 seconds.
How come these multi-corporations, international corporations, can come here and use my roads and my bridges and my railroads for nothing without paying? We built that.
Right.
We paid for it.
Right.
How can these multinational corporations get away with using it?
They can do it because according to our Supreme Court, multinational corporations based in other countries can also buy American politicians and regularly do. And the proof of that, I would say, is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Corky, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court this morning, you heard a case, Pamela Harris versus Pat Quinn, governor of Illinois. Harris v. Quinn is what it's called. And Pamela Harris is a health care worker, a home health care worker in Illinois. And these home care workers, they're represented by a union, a public employees union, SEIU, Service Employees International Union. And SEIU in the last couple of years has gotten them pay raises and, good workplace benefits. I mean, they're working in people's homes. Something like you have the right to rubber gloves paid for by your manufacturer, latex gloves. You have the right to, you know, certain hours. You have a right to – actually, their wage has gone up to like $13 an hour from like $7 an hour. And so – some of them decided that they didn't, but there's a price for this when you're represented by a union, and that is that you pay dues to the union, right? You pay the cost to the union of bargaining on your behalf. Pamela Harris said, you know, I'm not a member of the union, even though the union's representing me. And therefore, even though the union's representing me, I'm not a member. I don't want to have to pay for that cost of the union's bargaining with the state. for my paycheck. A paycheck, by the way, that was increased during the Blagojevich administration as a result of legislation that was passed by the House and Senate in the state of Illinois and signed by the governor. The House and Senate of Illinois during the Rod Blagojevich governorship said, you know, it would be appropriate if home health care workers, people working in other people's homes, mostly with elderly but also with disabled people, that if they at least made the minimum wage, right? They were making so little. So they raised the reimbursement rate, the state Medicaid rate reimbursement rate for these home health care workers. Well, today before the Supreme Court, Justice Sam Alito said to Attorney General Verrilli, he's the Solicitor General, thank you, General Verrilli, the guy who's arguing on behalf of the Obama administration in front of the Supreme Court. And I quote, I thought the situation was that Governor Blagojevich got a huge campaign contribution from the union, and virtually as soon as he got into office, he took out his pen and signed an executive order that had the effect of putting what was it, $3.6 million into the union coffers. General Verrilli says, whatever happened, Justice Alito says, well, that's the sequence, isn't that correct? And General Verrilli says, I think the issue before the court is the constitutionality of the statute that was enacted subsequent to that by a large bipartisan majority. In other words, this was a law that was passed by the legislature. He says, and I don't think it would be appropriate to look behind the legislature's action to consider and try and evaluate its motives. In other words, what, are you saying the union was buying off all the legislature? If you want to talk about that, let's talk about that. But that's not what's, you know, before the court here. But no, that's where Alito wanted to go. Kennedy is talking like he's been watching Fox News. I mean, it's just, it's insane. Union is going to do this stuff anyway. I'm going for a free ride. These are the people who are riding for free. Scalia. Actually, Scalia, it's really kind of hard to read what was on Scalia's mind today. But clearly there are four members of the Supreme Court who want to do this really radical thing. This is what Justice Kagan said. She said, what strikes me is that this is, and I'm going to use the word here, it is a radical argument. It would radically restructure the way workplaces across this country are run. And she's right. Doing away with public sector unions, basically. She said, it's essential to say that for 65 years, people have been debating the wrong question when they've been debating that because, in fact, a right to work law is constitutionally, I'm getting into the weeds here, But basically, there was an argument before the Supreme Court today that, mark my words, and we had this conversation, you'll recall, back in 2009 and 2010 when Citizens United was argued and was delivered, or maybe it was the spring of 2010, the fall of 2010, as I recall. And as soon as that decision came down, I was here reading pieces of it to you on the air, saying, you know, I wrote about this. Well, this morning, Shana went through this decision and found some very interesting. Justice Alito, Mr. Smith, what I don't understand is why the union's participation in this is essential. Oh, really? Justice Alito, you don't know why we have unions? I'd like to introduce you to a history book. It's incredible. Justice Kennedy. So let's assume that it's true that a union's position necessarily affects the size of government. Is not the size of government a question on which there are fundamental political beliefs, fundamental convictions that are being sacrificed if a non-union member objects to this line of policy? In other words, if you work for the government and the government's getting bigger, you shouldn't have the right to have a union. You know, you could kind of twist what not twist, you could kind of interpret what Justice Kennedy was saying as saying government employees, because they have, because they're inside government, might be in a position to influence how government operates. And therefore, they should not be allowed to have a union because unions tend to be political animals. So the cop and the firefighter and the home health care worker, they shouldn't have a union because that union, because they or the union might somehow influence government and then government pays them. That's the argument. I'll tell you why it doesn't make sense in a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Because you could say the exact same thing in the private sector. Isn't the union influencing the company to pay its workers better? Yes, that's the union's job. It's a democracy in the workplace. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Not a chance. Tracy in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Tracy, what's up?
I was just thinking about when I worked at Hardee's when I was 14. I'm 52 now. That's four decades of from the minimum wage back in $1.70. And now I just helped out at the Hardee's all summer. And the wage is $7.35. And I just don't understand why. I mean, I know the Republicans they have no integrity, so I'm not even going to talk about them. But the Democrats, like Bill Clinton, he wasn't laughed out of Davos. They kicked him out of Davos in 08. And I don't understand why he signed NAFTA and all these other things. It's an abomination that I would get up at 2:30 in the morning to make biscuits. I don't smoke. I'm not out on the sidewalk goofing off with people. I don't miss work. And they took the 4 days that I had, and then they reduced it to 6 hours for the week. Now, how am I supposed to pay lights and utilities? Why did the Democrats even go along with this repelling of Glass-Steagall? I don't understand that. It seems like that the Congress and the Senate, most of them are wealthy people. They're overly privileged, bloated, and just good for nothing. All of them are greedy up there, and I just don't even want to go around the world in any country and tell them I'm from the United States. It's embarrassing.
Well, we're not the only country that has a wealth problem, but we're right up there at the top, Tracy. There was a fascinating op-ed in yesterday, I believe it was, maybe the day before, is New York Times, where a fellow who had been a multimillionaire bond trader or some kind of trader, commodities trader, whatever he was doing on Wall Street, talked about how he had made millions and millions of dollars and finally got it that he was an addict, that he was addicted to that money. And, you know, kind of went through treatment for the addiction. And he said that he thinks that, you know, there's an actual genuine addiction going on here with these folks. But the idea that, you know, to speak to your life situation, I mean, the idea that somebody would work hard for 40 years and not be able to essentially have, you know, the quote American dream, you know, just a basic core decent life of decent health care, decent housing. You know, the ability to take a vacation every year, just simple stuff, doesn't seem right in this country, in the richest country in the world.
Well, I worked for NASA when I was 19 in the nuclear missile office in Huntsville, Alabama. And I'm getting ready to work with the IRS in a few days. And I'm picked as a manager, in an A class. So I'm an intelligent person. It's just that I just did this for the summer, I felt sorry for the people that were there. They were younger than me, and they don't even know what all the things you talk about on TV and on the radio. So I was trying to tell them, you ought to be angry. about what's going on, especially with the Democrats. I don't think that they're doing their part to take care of people who are.
Well, it depends on who you're talking about in the party. I you know, there are some very, very good Democrats out there, and there are some who are, you know. You know, point made, Tracy. Thank you very much, and thanks for calling and sharing your story. And as to Democrats who voted to blow up Glass-Steagall at the end of the Clinton administration, I just think it's a matter of, you know, when the last generation that remembers history dies, history starts to repeat itself because, you know, we've lost our memory of it. It's the only thing I can come up with. Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yes, Tom. Always good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'm kind of fighting the cold here.
It's okay.
The first fellow you had on, Alex McFarland, I really hope his doctor degree was strictly in theology because...
I believe it is.
He doesn't seem very much of a humanitarian. He just seems to kind of go along with the flow of just let the wretched die. And to kind
well,
of...
Well, no, his argument, and I don't want to say it's his argument. Let me say the argument because I don't want to speak on behalf of somebody who's not here. But the argument that conservatives make, and that actually Ben Franklin did make when he went over to England in the 1780s, when he first went over there, the argument is that if welfare benefits are too generous, you will create a permanent welfare class. And that's an argument that, you know, it's one of those situations where a germ of truth doesn't mean that the whole edifice is true, right? I mean, there is a kernel of truth buried inside there. But we're nowhere close to welfare benefits being so generous that you're creating a permanent welfare class. End of statement. Back to you, Susan. Sorry.
One question I've always wondered, the signature ring you wear, what is that stone? Is it, it's not just lapis.
Yeah, it's just lapis.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. The final thing I'll say is I don't know if you've heard much about Medicare, but because I am disabled, it's a strange letter that I got, and it has to do with ACO, which is the Accountable Care Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And whether I fill out the letter or I don't fill out the letter, they're still going to share my personal medical files with Medicare.
Good.
Just to give you a heads up on that.
Yeah, well, that's like the... I forget the acronym for the HIPAA, I think it was, that passed a couple of years back. And now when you go into your doctor's office, you've got to sign this thing saying that they can sell your records, they can share your records, they can, you know, they're just disclosing it to you here. And we've got no privacy left. Susan, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. John in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, John.
Hey,
up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
The caller for the guy who used to work at a burnt fast food place. That's the reason I was calling. I've got friends of mine that work for, I don't want to say the name of it, but it's a big restaurant food chain throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they have been putting, most of them were putting in like 35 hours a week or whatever, under the 40 hours a week. They were still in classes part-time, but they were working pretty steady. Now, because of the Affordable Care Act, they've all been knocked down to under 30 hours a week, and they've been complaining to me.
Well, John, tell them that if they were knocked down to 30 hours a week because of the federal the Affordable Care Act, that's against the law.
I did tell them that. I told them that's against the law, and they said, well, who do we complain to? I says, what you need to do is, one, you need to...
Well, hang on just a second. Number one, that's against the law. Number two... If they've been knocked down to 30 hours a week, they're probably earning little enough that under the Affordable Care Act, they can now get health insurance for free.
Yeah, that was one of the other things I told them. But a lot of them need that 30. They're under 30 hours, not 30 hours. They're under 30 hours.
Yeah.
And so, because if it's...
John, there is absolutely no accounting for unscrupulous employers in this country. I mean, that's just the reality right now that we're dealing with. Is that in a loose labor market, you get, you know, the wealthy, powerful people get to basically screw working people. John in Mundelein. How do you say that in Illinois there, John?
It's Mundelein.
Mundelein. Great. Thank you for calling.
What's sure. Up? Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of the show, but I got to tell you, I'm not sure who's mischaracterizing the case you were talking about here in Illinois. with regards to the unionization of home health care workers. Now, I'll tell you what I've heard. I heard the woman who is the plaintiff in the case being interviewed on another radio station here in the Chicago area.
Mm-hmm.
And she was claiming that she is not someone who works in other people's homes. She's a mom who takes care of her disabled child, and that the law compels people who stay at home and take care of their children, and they do get funding from the state. They are benefiting from payments from the state, but they are being compelled to join the union and feel they're being kind of...
If she's charging the state by the hour, then yes, that's the case. And
well,
and the argument is she a public employee or is she not? That's what's that's what this case is supposed to be, right? When this was brought to the Supreme Court, it was the debate was supposed to be, is this woman who is taking a paycheck from the state as a home health care worker? And the paycheck, the amount of the paycheck and the terms of her employment, whether she's caring for her own child or somebody else, is irrelevant. The amount of that paycheck was negotiated by Service Employees International Union. And she's saying, I don't want to pay the union for representing me, for being my agent. And the argument is that the argument that they originally tried to make was that because folks in her category can choose when to work and when not to work, they're not actually employees, that they're more like contractors. And therefore, SEIU shouldn't be able to represent them at all, that they're not actually employees of the state. Like I said, they're more like independent contractors. They're non-employees. And as non-employees, as not state employees, they should not be entitled to unionization and representation thereby. But that's not the case that actually got argued today. I mean, that was what got brought to the justices. But they went off on these wild tangents. John, you got to read the debate, the deliberations. It's absolutely incredible how this turned into basically let's relitigate the 1930s and the right to unionize. It's incredible. It's like Citizens United all over again. Thank you, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And this is something that conservatives used to hate. They used to call it judicial activism. Now it's all they do. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, well, that's interesting. Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
You're welcome, Tom. First off, I absolutely acknowledge the despicable behavior of the Republicans with their obstructionism and the filibusters and the caucus room restaurant meeting. I mean, that's what they've become. They're out in the open.
Yeah.
It's disgraceful. I mean, McConnell said it a couple years ago that they wanted to make him a one-term president.
Right.
But you know, I need to keep this real, Tom, because I started calling your program about 5 years ago, and one of my first calls was to tell you that the fix was in when the president appointed a Robert Rubin protege named Lawrence Summers to head his economic team, along with Mr. Geithner from the New York Fed,
yep,
and a whole bunch of Goldman Sachs folks. So,
you were right.
You know, he was a corporatist. He still is. Now, 5 years later, here we are. The president recently made a speech saying that we can't be bystanders in regard to this economy and the wealth inequality. You know, that's disingenuous, Tom, because it's his policies and his appointments that have perpetuated this race to the bottom. The South Korea trade deals cost thousands of jobs. Now he's pushing the TPP in secret, trying to fast track it. You've talked to Lori Wallach. You've talked to PAP. I mean, you like to defend this president whenever you can. I don't have a problem with that.
Cliff, so far I am not disagreeing with you at all. I think that you know, as a citizen rather than as a member of a political party, because I'm not sure that I am a member of a political party. I mean, I'm registered here in D.C. as a Democrat, I think, because you've got to
come to the green side, Tom,
to be able to vote in primaries. But in any case, my point is that I think that as a our obligation as a citizen is to point out when politicians do things wrong and we'll point out when politicians do things right, not to simply blindly follow them.
No, but that's sort of my point is that
I wrote a book opposed to the president's trade policies, published it 3 years ago.
Okay. But I just don't see on the air that you acknowledge his role in this economy. You seem to blame the Republicans, which they deserve a whole lot of blame, but I just don't see you, you know, acknowledging his role in this failing economy. He's sort of talking out of both sides of his mouth. He's saying he's going to talk to the manufacturers and try to create more jobs in this, but he's pushing the TPP on the other side. So it's sort of like we don't really know what we got here. We know what we got with the Republicans, but Obama is sort of an enigma.
I don't think he's an enigma at all. I think, you know, what you have is you've got, you know, a 2012, 2014 version of Bill Clinton. You've got a corporatist Democrat. You know, a classic kind of old school machine politics, you know, Democrat, you know, with a big D.
It's not how he campaigned.
Of course it's not how he campaigned. He campaigned as the guy who was going to be like FDR and was going to, you know, change everything and be all hopey and, you know, all that kind of stuff. He's not that. I think people have figured that out. What we have to do, I just don't find it useful to sit around and say, this guy's terrible. I would rather say, here's how we need to push him. Here's what we need to do. Here are the areas where we need to get involved to change the political dialogue in the United States, rather than just beating up on people who are arguably on my own side. That's my personal philosophy on that quote. We may disagree, but thanks for the call. Well, it looks like former Governor Bob McDonnell of Virginia just got charged in the Huffington Post headline, federal charges for governor giftee. Yeah. So it looks like it's happening right now. You have to, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's a sad thing when anybody just, you know, goes over the edge. It's just a sad thing. Lupe in Carrizo Springs, Texas. What's up?
Yes, Tom.
Hi, Lupe.
How are you doing? I've been watching your show for a couple of months now.
Oh, thank you.
I was wondering if you could, where does all the money from the taxes and state tax and federal tax, where does all that money go?
Well, state tax goes to the states and federal tax goes to the federal government. What do you mean?
Yeah, like that doctor was talking about the poor, how we're leeches and everything and this and that.
Right.
But even we pay taxes.
Poor people. Yeah, poor people in some cases pay higher taxes than billionaires.
Yeah, and doesn't some of that money go to the food stamp programs, Medicaid, and all that stuff?
Sure. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan changed the rules so that you pay income taxes on Social Security. And now people pay income taxes in most states on unemployment benefits. They pay income taxes on basically, you know, and plus, you know, you've got sales tax and you've got state income taxes and you've got gas taxes and you got, yeah, absolutely.
So in reality, we're not leeching off of nobody.
All right. Well, there is some redistribution of wealth from the very wealthy to the very poor in the United States. And in my opinion, there's not enough redistribution of wealth. You know, which I know makes conservatives' heads explode. I'm not an advocate of communism or anything like that, but I do think that our social safety net needs to be strong enough that people, you know, poverty devastates children. Poverty makes it hard for people to leap up into the middle class. Poverty, you know, poverty actually has a physical, measurable effect on the ability of people to function intellectually and even physically. And the consequences of poverty are really, really bad. We should view poverty as a disease in this country. You know, the way that we view alcoholism as a disease and just say, you know, we're going to do something about this. And this is the last president that we had that talked like this was Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah, but those people that are, their head is so high up in the air, think that, you know, just because a person is poor is leeching off the government.
Right.
That is not necessarily true. You know, like
right.
we pay our portion of our taxes.
No, I don't disagree. But even if you didn't, you know, even if you hadn't paid your portion of the taxes, if you are a human being in this country, You should not go hungry. We're a wealthy country. If you are a human being in this country, you should not go sick without access to health care. It should be a basic right. And I think if you're a human being in this country and you are an adult who wants to work, you should be able to have a job. That the right to a job, I agree with Martin Luther King and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that a job should be a right, not a privilege. And that if capitalism isn't going to provide a job, then government should. And good jobs, as Martin Luther King said, you know, jobs that actually lead to a positive future rather than just make work jobs. But, you know, I'm with you, Lupe. I'm totally supportive of your position. Thank you for the call. Donna in Susanville, California. Hey, Donna, thanks for calling. Donna? You're on the air? No, Donna must be listening to her radio or TV or whatever it is. Arthur in Homewood, Illinois. Arthur, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hartman. First, I want to say something. I don't want to argue. I'm not very articulate. But for one thing, I belong to the union. I belong to the Amalgamated Meat Cutters Union almost all my life.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I've got against the unions and the government, especially the schools, is that the schools don't make any money. There's no profit in school. There's no profit in government. Now, when I worked for this company, I'll name it Jewel, one of the best companies in Illinois, in Chicago, I should say. We worked hard, and we made a good profit, and we shared in that profit. But now the school, they get money to pay the teachers. Now, I'm not saying you got to get the taxpayer, and we're taxed to death. Do you know how much? Well, I'm going to tell you, there's over close to $300 billion in a hole on the program for the retirees and the teachers. Now, that shouldn't be.
No, it shouldn't.
Where are they going to get that money? Where are they going to get them? There's no profit in schools.
No, that money should be there, and if it's not there, it's probably not there either because it was invested badly during the Great Recession, in which case your discussion should be with the banksters, right? If the teachers' pension fund got invested with, you know, Goldman Sachs, and they ended up buying these exploding, you know, mortgage derivatives. You know, that's one of the main reasons why you've got pension funds all over the country that are hurting right now, is because they took that money. That money was put in by the workers. The money was put in by the teachers. And they invested, and then whoever was in charge of supervising that invested it, you know, badly.
What I can't understand is why you hit the rich people. Where are you going to go for a job? Poor people?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, you go. Oh, and here, one other thing.
I have started. No, seriously, Arthur. Entrepreneurs, most entrepreneurs that I've known in my life, and I'm one of them too, who have started businesses have done so when they are not rich. I started my first business using my unemployment check.
You got to remember, it's a gamble. When I opened up two stores, I sweated. Before I worked for the Jewel, I
borrowed $10,000 on my American Express line of credit to start a business. I understand
right,
that.
Right.
That doesn't mean that I should. That doesn't mean that I should treat my employees badly.
Invest their money.
That doesn't give me the right to treat my employees like crap, Arthur.
Oh no! I was never treated like that. Never.
Well, that's what you're defending, and I'm not attacking rich people for being rich. I'm saying that what's going on is we've got a situation in this country where rich people and the country and the companies that they basically run are screwing their workers, and I think it's wrong. I just think it's wrong. Arthur, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com and our website, tomhartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Very interesting. The the former Prime Minister of England, of the United Kingdom, Tony Blair, Teflon Tony, put in a marvelous performance. Let me back this up a little bit. George Monbiot, the writer for The Guardian and kind of general gadfly, runs a website called arrestblair.org. And if you can make a citizen's arrest of Tony Blair for, you know, lying the country into the Iraq war, or you get significant publicity for trying, the website will pay you. And they pay £2,150, about $3,000. Maybe it's a little more than $3,000. So, Tony Blair was having dinner with his family and a few friends at a fancy restaurant in downtown London called the Tram Shed. And one of the guys who works in the restaurant was familiar with the arrestblair.org website, and he went over and he said, his name was Twiggy Garcia. DJ and aspiring producer Twiggy Garcia told Vice he had fantasized for years about arresting Blair. And he says his heart rate increased when he discovered Blair's eerie presence in the building. So anyhow, here's what Mr. Garcia said. He said Tony Blair, was sitting at the head of the table upstairs in the restaurant with about eight other people eating dinner. I think he was out with his family and a few friends. I went over to him, put my hand on his shoulder, and said, Mr. Blair, this is a citizen's arrest for a crime against peace, namely your decision to launch an unprovoked war against Iraq. I'm inviting you to accompany me to a police station to answer the charge. Mr. Blair responded by saying, I think you should be more concerned about Syria, to be honest. Whenever somebody says to be honest, I always ask myself, wait a minute, you mean there are times when you're not? Do you ever listen sometimes? There are some people who just say, well, to tell you the truth, and I'm like, oh, really? There are times you don't? So, anyway, I realize it's just a turn of phrase, but it's always the English teacher in me. Mr. Garcia was not impressed, reports Felicity Morse and Jonathan Owen over at, I don't know the website, it didn't print the... Whoever printed this, it needs to set the defaults on your browser so that it prints the URL at the bottom of the page. So this looks like it came out of Raw Story, I'm guessing, but I'm not sure. Anyhow, he says, I didn't expect him to start debating with me. I think he actually believed the lies that were coming out of his mouth. This was what the barman said. So, I mean, there was a time once when I went down to Dallas and with Cindy Sheehan and a few other people, we stood across the street from the gated community that George W. Bush lives in and talked into bullhorns about war crimes. It's not so funny, though, when you think about 5 to 6 million people having their lives shattered, hundreds of thousands of people dead, a country blanketed in depleted uranium, having now the highest, worst birth defect rate in the world. It suddenly just isn't funny. It gets real serious. Mr. Twiggy said, I hope that... Twiggy wasn't his last name. It was his first name. Mr. Garcia said, I hope that it will keep people from forgetting that he is a war criminal. I hope one day he faces his charges in The Hague. People seem to think that those lies only apply to Nazis and African warlords. Good old George Monbiot. He's been on our show. Interesting guy. Another shocking wealth grab by the rich in just 1 year. Just 13 Americans made more in their investments in 2013 than the entire food stamp budget, which is substantial. It's an $80 billion budget. We're providing food stamps to 50 million people. You say, wow, that's a lot of food stamps. That's a lot of people. Well, actually, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, a buck and a, you know, a dollar a meal, more or less. It's a little more than that, just slightly more. And <clears throat> 13 Americans made more from their investments than the entire SNAP program. And the Republicans say, hey, we can't afford the SNAP program. Right. There are 12,000 people in the United States who are estimated to have made at least $40 million each in the past year. That's the 0.0001%. And the richest 400 individuals own three-fifths of America. The bottom 20% of households in the year 2013, the bottom 20% of households in America made nothing. The next 20%, the 61 to 80% percentile, the next 20% made about $333 a piece for the year. The middle fifth of Americans, the 41 to 60% of Americans, which is 24 million households, made about $4,000 each for the year. The next to the top fifth, the 21 through 40%, made about $13,000 each for the year. The top 20% made about $39,000 each for the year. This is from last year. The top 6 to 10% made about $100,000 each for the year. The top 2 to 5% made about $300,000 for each for the year. The top 1% made about $830,000 each for the year, but that's nothing. The top 0.1%, 120,000 families each made, and this is for every member in the family, made about $3,600,000 last year each. 120,000 families, the 0.01%, the 12,000 families made $40 million each. And the richest 400 individuals made an average of $750 million each, $750 million. Basically, we've reached a point where the only way that you can really get rich in America is to already be really rich. I mean, there's the occasional breakout from that that we all celebrate. The guy who invents something in his dorm room and becomes a billionaire, the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. But they're the exception that proves the rule. That capitalism is failing us here in the United States, at least the way that we're practicing it. And that it would be so much better for us as a nation, including for the very rich, frankly, if we did not have a nation that had horrible pockets of poverty in it, throughout it. If we did, you know, if 50 million people in our country didn't make so little that they qualified for food stamps, we should be saying, hey, wait a minute, we're the richest country in the world. I mean, the stock market grew by $4.7 trillion in 2013. The richest 1% owns 38% of all stocks. They're making their money. I mean, they say, oh, look at this. The stock market is growing. Isn't that great? The economy is strong. No, it means the rich are growing in their strength and in their finances, in their wealth. But working people, poor people, middle-class people, middle-income people, they're not seeing, you know, since Ronald Reagan came into office, they have not seen their wealth increase, other than the rare exception.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And there's something fundamentally wrong with that. And we're not having a conversation about that in the United States. There's no talk. There's no conversation about rolling back the rating tax cuts. So. Welcome back. Russell in Griffin, Indiana. Or Griffith. Excuse me. Hey, Russell. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you about the minimum wage.
Okay.
What do you think the minimum wage should be here in America?
Well, I think, first of all, that every state and municipality should have the right to raise above the federal minimum wage, whatever that is. But I think that the federal minimum wage, I think we have a fairly good empirical body of data that in 1968, the minimum wage was at a reasonable level. And if we were to set the minimum wage today, adjusted for inflation, at what it was in 1968, without any increase at all, just set it at what it was in 1968, it would be $10.10 an hour.
So don't you think we should press Congress and the Senate to do that?
I do. The president has asked for the minimum wage to be raised to $9 an hour, which is less than it was in 1968. The Progressive Caucus in Congress is pushing for $10 an hour. I think maybe $11 or $12 an hour would be not unreasonable. I think any of the above would significantly stimulate our economy. It would lift people out of poverty. It would generate increased tax revenues. It would be a good thing. Be a net good thing. Any of the above.
All right. Now on the Medicaid expansion,
mm-hmm.
The states that won't do it. What do you say about that?
I think this is purely political. You have Republican governors like Jan Brewer who said, you know, I'm going to take the Medicaid money because there's people in my state who need health care. And, you know, but there are other Republican governors who, like Rick Scott down in Florida or Rick Perry in Texas, who are refusing to take the Medicare money, Medicaid money, because they want to, you know, cause Obamacare to fail. And so you've got 4.2 or 5.2 million Americans now who are earning too much to qualify for state-based Medicaid. Like in Louisiana, if you earn over about $4,000 a year, you no longer qualify for Medicaid. But they're not earning the minimum amount that Obamacare will start providing, you know, a subsidy, even 100% subsidy. Like if you're making 130% of the poverty wage in Louisiana, you can get health insurance with virtually for free. But if you make a dollar less than that, suddenly you've got to pay the full price because Bobby Jindal didn't take the Medicaid expansion. The Medicaid expansion was part and parcel of Obamacare. And John Roberts in the Supreme Court set that aside. He blew a hole in that, which is allowing these Republican governors to do this. Now, it wasn't enough for the Republicans. They're very upset with John Roberts that he, from my point of view, harmed Medicaid, but from their point of view, that he used Medicaid as the wiggle room to get him out of knocking down Obamacare altogether. That's the argument they make. Am I making sense here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's
Roberts now, the Chief Justice now from Indiana. I'm from Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Now that guy's a crook. We know that. He took money to get his education, he did all this other stuff. Now he's saying, hey, well, the rest of us, man, you spend, you know, just go look other way.
It would be interesting to go back and look and see how the education of each one of the chief justices was paid for. Do you know for a fact, Russell, how John Roberts, you know, was how his school was paid for?
He worked for the mill, and he... That's where he got his money. He worked for the steel mills here in Indiana.
Huh. Interesting. Thank you, Russell. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us. And Desiree in Sheldon, Illinois. Hey, Desiree, what's up?
Well, I started off with one thing to say, but that was answered several callers ago. So I appreciate that.
You wanted to talk about the Supreme Court case today?
Yes. You and another guy caller answer my questions with that.
Mm-hmm.
There, too, I saw her more as an independent contractor versus an employee of the state.
Right. And keep in mind that when these right-wing think tanks decide to take a case to the Supreme Court, they find the most sympathetic possible plaintiff. and take that person to the Supreme Court. So let's not just find somebody who's doing, you know, care at home, you know, home care, but let's find somebody who's doing it in their own home. That'll, you know, is that kind of thing.
Exactly. But there too, the state of Illinois has far bigger pressing problems than just this. I mean, you know, it's just more people they can take money from to put towards other things.
Yeah.
I do have a question, though. I've been watching your show for a little while, and I've been deliberating with myself, like you said, to find a passion, something that you believe in a lot, and go after that. I have a conflict of interest, though. My boyfriend, the man that I live with, he works for a FS, Heritage FS. It's a farm supply.
Mm-hmm.
So he deals with all these chemicals. This is how he makes his living.
Right.
I've done the best I could think so far, and I've taken what he made some money, and I reinvested into good food for us, the best food that I can get around here. You know, can't grow nothing much this time of year.
Right.
But how would you approach something in that case? You know, where the money that you get, that you live off of, comes from the very thing that you despise.
Well, it's you're describing what's called a moral dilemma, and I would think that if he can earn a living in a time when it's so hard to have any job at all, if what he's doing is not criminal and is not actively destructive, that
no,
you know, people,
and there too, he knows problems that, you know, with the way that they've done things. We have the argument here at the house that, you know, he says organic can't see the world, and
I'm
on a free speech channel so he can listen for himself. It's a lot more good than arguing.
Yeah, I had this epiphanous moment back 20 years ago or so when our youngest child, we had caught her with some cigarettes, and at that time R.J. Reynolds was being condemned for their Joe Camel, you know, marketing to children, basically. And I was just so upset that it was like me and my wife up against a multi-billion-dollar corporation that was intent on marketing to my children a product that could kill them. And I snapped. I called up R.J. Reynolds. Their headquarters was in Atlanta. We were living in Atlanta at the time. I called up their headquarters, and this woman answers the phone, RJR. And I said, how can you work for a company like that? These people are selling death. And she burst into tears, and she said, I'm just a single mom trying to earn a paycheck. And it just, all of a sudden, I felt like a total fool, you know, and I got it, you know. I mean, we're all just doing the best we can here in this life. And if you've got to take a job that is not with the company of the highest ethics or the most wonderful thing in the world, you know, or even as a receptionist for RJR, take the job. You know, if that's how you do well by your family, take the job. In my opinion, if the job was robbing banks, I'd say something different. But you know, this is not illegal, so I'm not so bothered, frankly, by moral dilemmas of that type after having just had that experience. Does that make any sense?
Well, yes, it does, and I'm sure in time that, you know, I'll get it figured out. As I tell them, once I figure out what I'm going to do, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
But until then, I'm going to keep watching and keep myself informed of things that are going on.
Well, let me give you, by the way, the flip side of this, Desiree. When I was doing this show out of Portland, I was also doing a local show on the local Portland station, KPOJ, and I was doing the morning show for 3 hours, then I do my national show for 3 hours. And Walmart was advertising on that local station. And I spent a lot of time on the air criticizing Walmart. And in fact, there was the reason that they were advertising that local market was because there's this area of town in Portland called Sellwood, and they wanted to bring a new Walmart in, and Sellwood was fighting it. There were all people, houses all through Sellwood had these signs in their windows, no Walmart in Sellwood. Louise and I had been walking down the street one day in Sellwood about that time, and there was a guy standing, you know, next to the very heavily traveled street, holding up a sign that said, citizens for Walmart in Sellwood, or we need Walmart in Sellwood for jobs, or something like that, you know. And I walked up to him and I said, how much is Walmart paying you to hold that sign? And he said, $15 an hour. And we kind of laughed about the fact that he was making more than most Walmart workers. Laughed is the wrong word, but I thought it was ironic. And I talked about it on the air. But anyhow, Walmart bought an ad on my show. And somebody called up and said, how can you take Walmart's money? And I'm like, well, first of all, I have no control over that because the radio station makes those decisions, not me. But secondly, even if I did have the control over it, I'm not all that sure that I wouldn't take their money and do something good with it. So, you know, I think that you can, because what they're doing is legal. You know, I'm not opposed to Walmart. I'm opposed to trade policies that have made and welfare policies that have made Walmart's business model viable. Those are policy issues that need to be changed at the level of the federal government. If you think that the chemicals that your husband's company are working with are bad and they shouldn't be in the environment, that should be something you should take up with your member of Congress. Let's legislate this. Let's adopt the precautionary principle like they do in Europe. Let's fix this at the core, at the root. You know, pull the dandelion up by the root, not just go after the flower on the top, and truly change it. But just to criticize the companies or even worse, the people who work at the companies, I think is to criticize in the wrong place. Desiree, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I love stories. Pardon my storytelling here, but sometimes it helps make things real. Anyhow, we'll be back with more stories. It's Talk Radio for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. Moral dilemmas. That's a whole fascinating topic in and of itself. You know, how do you deal with moral dilemmas? Would you take a job working for a tobacco company? I have frequently said that I would not take advertising money from a tobacco company or a meat company, right? Meat packing plant or a slaughterhouse. Because I think what they're doing is violates my moral code. But what Walmart is doing is, you know, basically just retail. Retail doesn't violate my moral code. They're doing it in a way that I don't think is appropriate or right. But it is legislation. It is, you know, we have to. It is our elected representatives who created that environment for that business model, both with trade policies, bringing all this stuff made overseas, mostly in China, and with the so-called welfare reforms of the 1990s that created a subsidy-driven business model for welfare for McDonald's and for Walmart and for Yum Foods and for all these other companies. So where do you draw the lines? I guess we all have to figure that out for ourselves. And anyhow, Stephen and Teton, Washington. Am I saying it right, Stephen?
Tyotin.
Tyotin.
How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Along your free trade agreement conversation earlier,
mm-hmm.
When I was killing time Sunday waiting for the bowl games, I turned on one of the Senate's channel, and I was watching Justice Stephen Boyer answer questions and have conversations with a bunch of Ivy League law students.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about Breyer?
Yeah, Breyer.
Breyer.
Did I say it wrong?
Yeah, well, just slightly.
And one of them asked him, why don't we change that free trade agreement back that Clinton signed in?
Right.
And he had an odd answer. It's like it's rare or hardly ever that you can reverse a decision like that. It's nearly impossible.
Yeah.
And that his consensus was it was perfectly legal, and why shouldn't the rich people be able to buy a vote?
Oh, you're talking about Citizens United. You're not talking about the free trade deals.
Yeah. Yeah, Citizens United.
Stephen Breyer, a liberal who voted against Citizens United, said, why shouldn't rich people be able to buy a vote?
Yeah. He said it's perfectly legal, and if they have the money to create it into a law, then it's legal.
Oh, to create into law something like the TPP.
Yeah.
Or free trade. Huh. Interesting. Whoop. I'm sorry. I just dropped my collar. I put my hand down on the button. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hang up on you. But anyhow, Tea Party Dave is on the line with us in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I automatically moved to the next caller. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing there?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I see the snow coming down, some of the global warming coming down behind you.
Yes, indeed. There you go, Tea Party Dave.
It's raining down behind you. Hey, I just because I was listening to some of your conversation.
It actually, Dave, by the way, it actually probably is global warming that is causing this severe cold weather.
Well, snow is. It's global warming. But.
Yeah, well, it's what's happened is that jet stream, that fairly strong flow of cold air in the upper atmosphere that used to block this kind of weather from all this cold, high-pressure weather from coming down from the Arctic. Has gotten weakened because it's gotten warmed. And so the temperature, you know, gradient has changed. And the consequence of that is that this cold air is spilling down on us. It's like, you know, you just never anticipate. This is, you know, chaos systems, right? It's something as complex as the weather. It's almost impossible to say, okay, if it goes up 1 degree or if atmospheric moisture, for example, water vapor, there's 5% more moisture in the atmosphere now than there was 40 years ago. And that water vapor both traps heat, it's a greenhouse gas, and, you know, it influences the climate in as much as it defines how much moisture comes out, the severity of storms, stuff like that. So, you know, we're going to try and figure out what this is going to do. You can't figure it out. I mean, who would have thought that global warming would produce, you know, a weakened jet stream that would allow for, you know, these high pressure clumps of, you know, just blobs of cold air to come down from the Arctic. Who would have thought?
I think you're just proving my point that we don't know. Whenever you say that, we don't know. You just.
Yeah. No, that's my point. We don't know what the consequence is going to be. We just know that there's going to be a significant consequence.
When you don't know.
Right.
We don't know.
Right. We just know that there's going to be a significant consequence. The two things that we do know is that things are going to change and that the extremes are going to become more extreme. And those are already happening. But what's going to change where? Where are the droughts going to happen? Where is it going to get wetter? Where is it going to get drier? Where is it going to get colder? Where is it going to get hotter? They're still figuring that stuff out.
Well, isn't that a part of the evolution of the planet over 4 billion years?
Yeah, but we've pulled out of the Earth and thrown into the atmosphere 300 trillion tons of carbon dioxide that the atmosphere was not expecting. And that's never happened before. That's never happened in the entire history of the planet. And
I disagree, but I didn't want to talk about that.
Okay. All right. What did you want to talk about?
I know we got started on that, but I didn't want to go
in
that direction. Anyway, I wanted to go back to the Supreme Court decision on the public service unions and that sort of thing.
Sure.
And the part is that I disagree with you, and I just can't understand how you're supposed to be so intelligent, and I have no education whatsoever.
I make no claims to intelligence, Dave.
I beg your pardon?
I make no claims to intelligence. You've never heard me say that I'm so intelligent.
Well, you sprout so much knowledge that, you know, I thought you knew so much. How can you... Here's my main point, and I don't know how anyone could ever dispute this. The major difference between a public service union and a private service unit is the public service union can pick and elect their own bosses by the fact that they are a public union. And I'm going to make this just as throw this out. Boeing. Let's just pick Boeing as a example.
Okay.
How can what influence does the union have over who's elected all the corporate officials? How do they elect the corporate officials?
The stockholders do. I suppose if the union held a lot of stock in a pension fund, they might have some small amount of influence. But
in a public service union, how much influence do they have over elected officials in, let's say, a city, a county, a state?
Right.
How much influence does that union have over the election of an individual?
I think probably typically very little. The union's job is to negotiate on behalf of the workers.
You mean public, the SEIU, the ASME, they have no influence over public service over officials that get elected.
Oh, you mean are unions politically active? If their members want them to be, and if you are in one of those unions, or even if you're just covered by one of those unions, if you don't want them using your money for whatever their political agenda is, you can refuse to give it to them, or you can ask them to give it back to you. That's the law.
Does that happen?
Yeah, it happens a lot. In fact, it's a major problem for unions. In some states, you have more people saying don't use my money for politics than you have saying use my money for politics, because they disagree with the politics of the union. But they do want the union representing them. I mean, the fact of the matter is that you can decertify a union anytime you want with a majority vote.
I couldn't disagree more, because you look at just a simple city we have here in Pittsburgh, and what. It's just to say, well, the firefighters union, the SEIU, the AFSCME, has no influence whatsoever over the election of the official.
No, I'm not saying they have no influence. What I'm saying is...
Good. Well, see, that's the difference. That's the difference.
What is wrong?
Here,
Dave, I don't understand how you're so opposed to democracy. Why are you opposed to a bunch of people...
Roosevelt.
Hang on just a second here. Let me ask you the question, if I can, before you give me the answer, all right? Why are you opposed to a bunch of people in the workplace who happen to work for the government getting together and deciding that they want to be politically active together? Why are you opposed to that?
Because as being a collection, because they are the same people employed by the people they elect.
Right. And what's wrong with that?
Because once they elect the people that got them elected, what do you I can't believe we're back to naivety again. What do you think a politician thinks about it? I heard one actually tell me this. What do they think about? What is the first thing on their mind every morning and the last thing on their mind every night?
Probably the next election.
You got it.
Which means that they need to do what people want them to do. They need to do what their constituents want them to do. And you're trying to tell me that
thing they want to ensure they would be.
But Dave, what you're missing is that a union is a democracy. If the majority of the people in the union don't want that union behaving in that way, they change it. So what's wrong with a democracy within a democracy? I mean, how's that any different than a democracy within a kingdom? You've got a democracy within Boeing, within the kingdom of Boeing. Or you've got a democracy within the democracy of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. What's wrong with that in either case?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I guess it became a rhetorical question because we hit the damn break. I'm sorry, Dave. But let me ask you literally, or anybody else, what's wrong with that? Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. The argument that Dave is making is the... unionized employees get to pick their bosses argument, and therefore their boss will give them more, and then they can, you know. But if you look at history, what you see is that it's not wildly abusive. It's not like the unions are getting, you know, massive amounts of money. And I mean, maybe in some corrupt, maybe in Chris Christie's New Jersey, I don't know. But you know, it's like those are the exceptions, not the rule. And what you do with the exceptions is you fix them. You root out corruption. You change the system. You don't just do away with the ability of people to have a democracy in the workplace. I mean, that's crazy. Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia.
Hi. Well, we've hit right on my topic, because I think that we need more democracy in the workplace. I think we need to form co-ops with everybody listening right now. You need to, before the week is out, get involved with somebody who's forming a cooperative.
That's great. Marcia, can I put you on hold for a minute, please? Okay. Because you're listening on WCPT, and they're in a commercial break right now, and I want you to be talking to the other folks who are listening to WCPT as well. Donna in Columbia, California, who's watching Free Speech TV, which is not in a commercial break right now. Hey, Donna, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to talk about how pension funds were duped into making bad investments through fraud. By law, they're not allowed to invest in anything other than AAA investments.
Right.
This is where the rating agencies came in and knowingly packaged subprime mortgage-backed securities as AAA. They knew this was a scam. The banks knew these securities were a scam. That's why they purchased insurance through AIG. Everybody made money except for the pension funds.
Excellent
point. It was a scam,
point.
And it was fraud.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Thank you, Donna, for the call and for sharing that. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Everybody keeps talking about corporate greed and how one percenters have approximately 49% of the world wealth, which is considered to be $110 trillion. As these corporations continue to get more powerful and richer, what is their point when they have the whole, all of the money? What will they? What is their next step? What is the game plan?
It's kingdom. It's feudalism, in my opinion.
Is it my kingdom? Are they going to take my whole country?
I think they're about three-quarters of the way there.
Yeah, and so what are we supposed to do? Just walk into the sea?
No, no. I think that we are supposed to wake up and fight back using the tools that the Constitution provides, using our democracy. And the step one, in my opinion, is to get money out of politics so that we can do all the other steps that are necessary. And getting money out of politics means that we have to undo the Supreme Court's decision, the Citizens United decision, that said that money is the same thing as speech and therefore is protected under the First Amendment. Money should not be protected by the First Amendment. The founders were very suspicious of people with lots of money. The founders were not billionaires. They weren't even millionaires by today's standards. They were the upper middle class of the day, not the very rich. And in fact, most of the very rich fled and went back to England or went up to Canada. And so that's what I would say. We need to get active. Norma, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In just a second, in just one minute, I'm going to pick up Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. But first, Marcia got cut off. She's listening to WCPT. Marcia, you wanted to make a pitch for co-ops.
I definitely do. I really feel that we all should get involved in forming a cooperative, and that's not just a grocery store. There's a great YouTube that I will post on your Facebook page that people should take a look at from Mondragon. But I feel that forming those cooperatives and being involved in them will teach us also more about democracy, will teach us about voting and how to analyze social issues and make choices. And I feel that, you know, we spend so much time at work that if all of us were in cooperatives all the time, that would be a boon to us.
Yeah.
And in terms of getting money out of politics, I mean, that's, you know, it's money out of politics, money out of corporations, all that money is causing us big problems.
Yeah, I'm with you. Marcia, we're out of time here, but thank you for sharing that. I totally agree with you. I've been to Mondragon in Spain. It is fabulous. I look forward to that video. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Happy snow day.
Yeah.
Boy, is it snowing
snow
out.
Snow day, isn't it?
Snowmageddon? Yeah. Is this going to be Snowmageddon like the fabled?
Oh, I was here. I had to move out of my house for 10 days.
Seriously?
Yeah, because I lost power. The entire complex lost power. It was 32 degrees.
Whoa.
And my car, which is a white Miata, Mazda Miata, was buried. You couldn't see it.
A white car buried by snow. And okay, yeah. So this isn't going to be that bad, right?
No, I don't think so. Okay. No, I don't think so. I think we're going to have about 7 inches, 8 inches. But that's bad for Washington. We don't do snow.
Right, right.
We're a southern city.
There you go. So yeah. So what's going on in the world?
Former Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell and his wife Maureen were charged today with illegally accepting gifts, luxury vacations, and large loans from wealthy Richmond area businessman Johnny Williams. He sought special treatment from state government, prosecutors say. They were charged with 14 felony counts, including wire fraud, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, obtaining property under color of their official office, and conspiring to do the same.
Wow. Was Johnny charged with anything?
Johnny cooperated.
Oh.
So I'm not sure that he was. Authorities say that McDonald and his wife basically lodged near constant requests for money, clothes, trips, golf accessories, private plane rides. I mean, it's quite unbelievable. When you consider that in 2012, McDonald was considered a possible vice presidential candidate and just a year ago was considered a credible future candidate for president.
Mm-hmm.
And it all unraveled because he was considered a straight arrow and a very nice man. But it happened because of a tip to a state fraud hotline alleging that the chef at the state's 200-year-old executive mansion was pilfering food from the kitchen, and it all went wrong from there.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
What else is up?
President Obama will meet Pope Francis at the Vatican on March the 27th. President's looking forward to discussing with Pope Francis their shared commitment to fighting poverty and growing inequality, dovetailing with what you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Growing inequality.
Right. Are there any specific proposals, or is this just let's all make nice words?
I think this is make nice words. I mean, I don't know that you make proposals exactly when you meet the Pope.
Right.
But
yeah.
I think it's make nice words, and I think it's kind of a big deal. And it's an interesting time because you've got some on the right in the U.S. Catholic Church who are opposing some of the things that Pope Francis has been saying. And then you've got Democratic members of the Catholic Church who have really been supporting what the Pope has been saying.
Right.
It's an interesting time for him to go.
Yeah, yeah.
The ACLU is suing Utah in an attempt to force the state to recognize the more than 1,000 same-sex marriages performed during the brief window earlier this year that filed today. Also, six gay couples filed a lawsuit today challenging Florida's constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. Also, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals today held that lawyers cannot exclude potential jurors from a jury based on their sexual orientation. So three major pieces there.
Interesting.
Yeah. Also, a report on the torture and killing of 11,000 detainees in Syria, which I had a piece about in my news notes, which was in The Guardian. Is horrific and suggests systematic violations by the government.
Right.
The State Department spokeswoman Murray Half said they're horrific, extremely disturbing, horrible to look at, and saying that the killings underscore the importance of making progress on an agreement that will get a political transition in place. And, of course, the talks start later this week in Geneva to do just that.
Yeah, let's hope they can produce some results. Did you see where Tony Blair got citizen arrested?
I did see that Tony Blair got citizen arrested.
This is like the eighth time now, because George Monbiot has this website called arrestblair.org where this guy is getting a $2,100 bounty.
It's pretty shocking, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Anyhow, back to you.
What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I guess it's a free country.
It's a free country. I mean, it is a free country, relatively. I mean, and he can't not go out.
Mm-hmm.
He always gets security, I suppose.
Yeah.
Chris Christie was sworn in for a second term today amid swirling snow and scandal. He did not directly address Bridgegate in his wide-ranging speech that wasn't very long. He called for Democrats and Republicans to serve the citizens of New Jersey and work together.
That's great. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great to talk with you. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We will be back. It is about 2 minutes before the hour. And we're gonna be back with David Cobb, the national spokesman for Move to Amend. Get an update. Today is the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United decision. It's worth discussing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And David Cobb, the national spokesperson for Move to Amend. MoveToAmend.org is on the line. Today is the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. And a quick heads up, as a, you know, apropos of that anniversary, Free Speech TV will air a special presentation of Move to Amend's new short film, Legalize Democracy, tonight at 9 p.m., produced by Dennis Traynor of Acronym TV. So be sure and check that out. David, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure to be on.
It's always great to have you with us. So, you know, we talked with Caitlin yesterday, I think it was, briefly, and kind of got an update on what's going on. But tell me, from you've been traveling all around the country, where are we at?
Well, listen, I'm going to tell you that we are way further along than I thought we would be. You know, Move to Amend was only founded in 2010, and you know it because you were one of the first 50 people to actually join. So we went from about 50 when we launched. Today, Tom, we are at 325,000 and growing.
Wow.
We have helped 500 communities pass resolutions in support at the city council or county governmental level. We have put it on the ballot 50 times where ordinary citizens can vote on it. And, Tom, that includes traditionally Republican and conservative areas like rural Wisconsin, where in Ryan's district, in fact. We put it on the ballot in rural Ohio, where they were voting for Mitt Romney by over 70% of the vote. We put it on the ballot in the state of Montana, in Utah. Tom, we put it on the ballot in conservative areas, liberal areas, middle-of-the-road areas. We haven't lost a single one of them. In fact, we've also helped 16 states pass resolutions of support, and Move to Amend has helped to organize over 150 local affiliates, local citizens coming together to commit themselves to a constitutional amendment to make it clear only living, breathing human beings have inherent and inalienable constitutional rights, and that money is not speech. Because we know what you know, what your listeners know, because they watch you and listen to you, and that is, this problem is not just about money and politics. This is about stealing our sacred right to self-government by creating an illegitimate idea that corporations have constitutional rights, which means corporate lawyers can overturn public interest laws, environmental protection laws, worker safety laws, as well as campaign finance laws. So when you ask me where we at, we way further than I thought that we would be, but we've got a lot further to go.
We're talking with David Cobb, the national spokesperson for MoveToAmend.org. David, there's a bunch of other groups over the last couple of years that have kind of jumped on this bandwagon, and no small number of politicians. And very often they say, you know, sign our petition, and by the way, send us $25 or send us your email address or whatever to roll back Citizens United. Or sign our petition to say that corporations aren't people. Why is it that those measures are not adequate to the task ahead of us?
First, I want to acknowledge that we, too, use a petitioning process as an organizing tool. So I don't fault anybody for using organizing tools to organize people.
Yes.
I do think that one thing that makes Move to Amend very unique is that we don't just organize names and do internet activism. We actually do trainings,
We do workshops. We do presentations. We launch ballot initiatives. We do bird dogging campaigns. We do canvassing. We do the legalized democracy. We actually put our people, we give them tools and train them on how to use them to become more engaged citizens. Because as you cover on your radio program and on your television program, there is no shortage of problems that we need to have good, effective citizen action on. So I think that's one of the things that makes us different. Another thing that makes us different, and I want to say this lovingly, but honest, clearly and honestly, and that is we are sincere that we are not going to compromise a constitutional amendment that is clear and unambiguous, that no artificial entity has the inherent and inalienable constitutional rights of human beings. Because, you know, Tom, the Constitution doesn't create these rights. The Constitution recognizes these rights.
And protects.
And protects them
from government trampling.
Exactly, and protect them. And we agree with that, Tom, because think of it this way. In a very big way, the Constitution exists as a shield that says, stop. Government, you can come no further because I am a human being and I have rights. And even if government and the political process does not like what I have to say, I have the inherent and inalienable right to express myself. I have the right to worship or not as I choose. I have the right to associate with who I want. Government should not be able to infringe upon those areas. And Tom, this is a dangerous thing. If a corporation or a nonprofit corporation or any artificial entity created under the laws of the state can use the power to say government stop, it means that we the people cannot control the institutions that we actually create through the state legislative process to incorporate at all. And we are different because we're not going to compromise on that. We do not believe that any artificial entity has any inherent and inalienable constitutional rights. It is an illegitimate legal doctrine created by the courts. It is illogical. It is immoral. And we are fusing that because we know that corporate personhood is not the only legal doctrine, but the equally odious, also court-created doctrine that says that money equals political speech. Those two things must be fused in our democracy movement because, as our documentary says, we have to legalize democracy in this country because currently we the people have not only had our sacred rights stolen from us to self-government, but what pisses me off as a lawyer, Tom, they're using our legal system to legalize the fact. And we at Move to Amend say, ya basta, enough already. We need to build a broad, deep social movement that's multiracial, multiethnic, that cuts across political ideologies, but is clear and unambiguous that the concept that we the people are sovereign and we rule ourselves, that is sacred. That is sacrosanct.
Well, and this is one of the areas where the Tea Party folks, I mean, setting aside the billionaires who fund the Tea Party, they disagree with you and me. But the average person who shows up for a Tea Party meeting and says, you know, government, get out of my life, they agree with people like me who, you know, I call myself a liberal or even a democratic socialist. We just agree. You know, this is
Tom, I have given my standard presentation to Occupy groups and I get applause. I get laughs and I get a lot of encouragement. And you know what? I've given this presentation to Tea Party groups, and I get laughter, I get applause, I get encouragement. Now, I want to be clear, that laughter and applause comes at totally different places.
Hmm.
But it still comes. The core idea that we the people govern ourselves, that government does not have the right to infringe upon our core political and civil rights, there is virtual unanimous consensus amongst the American people. If you ask the question that way, we agree. And that's why Move to Amend is very clear. We're not an issue. We're a principle. We're a movement that says you may disagree with David Cobb or Caitlin Tsiposi-Belknap or Jerome Scott or any of the rest of our national leadership spokespeople. You may disagree with us on individual issues, but if you agree with us that the Constitution of the United States was created in order to form a more perfect union, that it exists
to make it clear that we, the people, govern ourselves and that we get to decide how our institutions operate, with this one important exception, and that is no institution associated with government in any way can infringe upon the individual inherent and inalienable rights of a living, breathing human being. If you agree with that, you actually agree with Move to Mend. And that's the reason we've been able to actually reach across political ideologies and say, we're going to have fights over issues, but around the concept of how our government operates, let's get together and take it back.
Yeah, yeah. It's remarkable. David Cobb, the national spokesperson for Move to Amend. MoveToAmend.org is the website. Tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, calibrate for your local time, wherever it may be, on freespeech.org and, on Free Speech TV, if you have Free Speech TV, Dish, Direct, they're on a lot of cable systems, too. The film Legalized Democracy will be playing. So, David, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for what you do to get the word out to the American people.
There you go.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I will keep doing my best to do that. Whoops. Hit the wrong button. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Kay in San Anselmo, California. Hey, Kay, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, Tom. Please excuse me. I have a bad cold.
That's quite all right. What's up?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. President Obama has put the name of a gentleman, his name is Mr. Fisher, forward for the job as assistant to Ms. Yellen at the Fed, okay? This gentleman, he was head of the Israeli bank, and also he has dual citizenship with Israel. And in these sensitive jobs, well, number one, I think anybody in the government should not be in the government if they have dual citizenship with another country. What do you think?
I'm inclined to agree with you. I don't know who this guy is or anything about him, so I can't give you an intelligent response.
His name, and he looks like he's an elderly man.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran he was head of the Israeli bank.
Yeah.
And
well, that
he has dual citizenship.
I'm guessing that the Obama administration, assuming that everything you're saying is accurate, I'm guessing that the Obama administration would say that that's good experience for him, that, you know, he learned how to do it there. Frankly, I personally don't have any idea. I can't speak to it, Kay. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for the heads up, though. I will look into it and see what I can find out about it. It sounds fascinating. It sounds very, very fascinating. Alan in Lancaster, Ohio. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can. You wanted to talk? Is my voice faint?
No, you're fine.
Okay.
Yeah, Tom, I enjoy watching your show. Been watching you for about a year. I agree with most everything you say. But one of the things I want to say is I'm sort of one of those people who are an advocate that we need a sort of a third party, a progressive party that advocates for the middle class. And mm-hmm. I know when a lot of people call your show, you kind of push them, well, we have the Democratic Party. And my problem with the Democratic Party is they don't seem to be advocating very well for the middle class. If you take a look at, our society, all new technology, all new businesses, everything seems to come out of the middle class. If you take guys like, Steve Jobs or, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, these guys all came out of the middle class. If you go back to...
Well, they all came out of actually the upper middle class, but yes.
Right, but they were all middle class, lower middle class, middle class, or whatever. If you go back, to...
No, I mean, they all had parents who were making incomes that in today's dollars would be hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, if you...
Well, I know that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Elon Musk did.
Right, well, they weren't that much, but they all came out of the middle class. And you go back to Edison, even Rockefeller.
But anyhow, we got 30 seconds. Your point,
these guys,
is what?
My point is, when we're allowing, these Republicans and the billionaire, 1% that support them, and to do what they're doing and destroy the American economy, and this lie that all great things and our jobs and everything that we have in the middle class comes from, the wealthy.
Right.
It's not true. It comes from...
So you're saying that the destruction of the middle class is not a good thing for the United States, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that it will diminish entrepreneurship. I absolutely agree with you. And most of the entrepreneurs I know are out of the middle class, more or less. You know, however we define that, they're not wealthy people. Thank you, Alan. Thanks a lot. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bruce in Wilmette, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I love your show. Listen, you talk about wealth and inequities, and then you say we will never pass a wealth tax. But 10 years ago, people thought we'd never pass marijuana laws.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever said we'll never pass a wealth tax. It's just that the billionaires who fund the Republicans and their sock puppet Grover Norquist have done such a good job of getting everybody in the Republican Party to salute this flag of no tax increases that the country's in paralysis.
Well, I think the tax code is a fraud, and I think you'd probably agree with me.
I think the tax code is a mess. I'm not sure it's a fraud, but it's a mess. Yeah.
Well, it's fraudulent that the NFL and General Electric pay no tax.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically set up so that rich people do really well and poor people and working people, pay the bills.
Okay, let me tell you a quick story. I was raised a Republican. In 1980, Ronald Reagan said the government is the problem, and we are taking money from the average American and wasting it on programs.
Right.
And I think that argument still rings true with middle America. And I think the only way around it is to say, okay, we're going to give you guys a wealth tax. We're going to give the first 100,000 tax-free of net wealth, which is going to wipe out taxes on middle-class Americans. And we're going to tax the rest.
Well, if you're talking about net wealth, I mean, a lot of people have a house that they own that's worth more than $100,000 who are not, who are making $40,000 a year. They just have been accumulating value in that house for the last 30 years.
Yeah, but if you take off their debt and you tax them at 2% on what's left, it's going to be way less than what their income tax is.
Right.
So if we take the burden off of the middle class and put it on the wealthy, it's going to be a lot easier to change the way we do things socially in this country.
I don't disagree that a wealth tax would be a very good idea, given how bloated the extreme wealth at the very top has become. I it's going to take a lot of time to unwind this incredible concentration of wealth that we've seen happen in this country. And I wouldn't want it to happen. I wouldn't want that unraveling to happen the way that it did in Russia, for example, right after the turn of the last century, with the Bolshevik Revolution. I mean, it's not, frankly, I think that's what Franklin Roosevelt avoided successfully, is he kept us from either a fascist or a communist revolution and kept us going down the road of basically democratic socialism, of a system, a semi-free market, semi-capitalist system that where the government was the employer of last resort and the government provided a social safety net. I'd just like to return to those days. I'd just, roll back the Reaganomics. Bruce, thanks for the call. Good point. Javier in Denver, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. You want to disagree about Walmart?
Yeah. Okay. So the study came out about a year ago that people who show sociopathic tendencies are more than the propensity to be CEOs, and business and politics intersect. So it's not that I'm saying you need to. I don't agree with hate in any form, but we are opposed. Not we. I'm not speaking for you, but it's like I am opposed to the people who work for these corporations, because there's no way in heck that I, as an African American, will buy certain products or do certain things. And sometimes it does affect the way I interact with people socially. I don't want to go here. I would prefer not to do this. And sometimes even when I meet people and I tell them, hey, man, I'd rather not buy a car, and things like that. And I live in Denver, So it affects the way you the way that we're approaching this. If we say, well,
no, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I've gone through this for the last 40 some odd years about being a vegetarian. I mean, it's just, you go out to dinner with somebody and it becomes a political statement. You know, I'm not kidding. I mean, you know, there are people who are offended by the fact that I don't eat meat.
I can relate. And I'm African American, so sometimes, you know, I feel like when you say certain things and you say, well, I feel this way, they say, oh, well, you know, don't be this way. Don't be a Malcolm X. You know, that time has passed, and it really hasn't. Those times from the 60s now, you know, the essentially the slave system still exists where this. Basically, what I'm trying to say is minimum wage is what they would pay a slave owner per day to house and feed his slave. So the slave system still exists in a way, and you can't support Walmart, and you can't support these certain businesses. And, you know, you have to, if you do, what I say, if you are going to buy a certain product, buy it used. Don't support that person.
I agree with you, Javier. The point that I was making is that what Walmart is doing is very different from what Sam Walton started out doing. When Sam Walton started Walmart, first of all, they had big banners across the Walmarts that said Made in America. I mean, that was the core of their store, was that they sold American-made goods. And they were paying reasonable wages. And two things happened from the time that Sam Walton started that store until today. The first was free trade. We got these free trade agreements. And so Walmart stopped buying American-made stuff and started buying Chinese-made stuff because it was available to them and they could make more money. And their mandate is to make money. And then the second thing that happened was in 96, we got so-called welfare reform. Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton got together and did away with and said nobody's going to be on welfare for more than 5 years. Therefore, if they're going to continue to get benefits after that, they have to have a job. So, you know, if the job doesn't pay well enough, then we will subsidize them. And basically what that has turned into is a business model for Walmart. Both of those things are not because somebody at Walmart sat around and said, let's do this. It's because basically our government, you know, our elected officials did these things. They set up this business model. In fact, you know, in both cases, it was largely Democrats responsible for it, although Republicans were, you know, gung-ho for these things. And so I think that we need to fix what we have done is we have rigged the game so that it works best for Walmart. And we need to change that. We need to unrig the game. We need to change the trade laws and change the tax laws. And the welfare programs. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I agree. It's just a word of the day, man, but I agree.
I think you know, you need to get to the core of it. You need to get, and this is the kind of analysis that Malcolm X was putting forward. The system is corrupt. The system itself is corrupt. Or the system is racist. Or the system is, you know, fill in the blank. And so you don't just fix the symptoms of that corruption. You fix it at the core. You fix it. You legislatively change it. Javier, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day, my analysis, and your thoughts on that right after this. Fair and only slightly unbalanced, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Mike in Waukegan, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. You want to talk about the drug war?
Yeah. Well, I thought I heard you say maybe earlier in the show about the budget for the, I think it was the food stamp program was like around $80 billion.
Right.
Okay. I heard a spokesman for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP, mentioned that the drug war costs about the same, about $80 billion. A year, which means since about the turn of the century, we've spent over $1 trillion on it. And I'm thinking, you know, everyone's trying to change laws in this country. You know, now it's marijuana, and this is just going on at such a slow pace. Why doesn't Congress just cut the budget to the dreaded jackbooted, goose-stepping Drug Enforcement Administration, which we need like a hole in the head? I don't understand. You know, if you think about it, we're giving them the money and we're cutting of social programs.
My take on this, Mike, is that we need to, and I'm not sure that you'd have to do away with the DEA to do this, that we need to stop treating drugs and drug abuse as a crime and start treating it as a disease. And so if we took the money that we use, I mean, particularly when you consider that half the people in America in prison are there because of drugs, directly or indirectly, or actually it's far more than half if you add the indirectly. If we started viewing these things as you know, addiction problems or as medical crises or whatever, I think we'd be a much healthier society. And but the problem is there's so much profit now being made. I mean, since Nixon, you know, the Nixon's war on drugs, which in some ways came out of Rockefeller's drug war in New York State when he was Nelson Rockefeller, when he was governor there before the Nixon administration. And he really started cranking up the drug laws, and then Nixon took the thing, you know, national in the 70s. And the consequence of this has been that you've got large, well-funded, you know, drug task force in local police departments, in state police departments, in county law enforcement, at the federal level. I mean, it's not just the DEA. And so I think that, you know, A, those bureaucracies are going to fight for their own survival. And B, they have a lot of allied industries associated with them who are going to be lobbying for them. I mean, the manufacturing and selling drug testing kits is a multi-billion-dollar business, for example. So, you know, how do we turn that ship rather than blow it up? Am I making sense? I'm mangling metaphors here, Mike.
Tom, I'm just wondering. In other words, you're kind of saying, like, we can't approach it from a financial point of view. In other words, we can't go after them and cut their funding.
I think you could. I just don't think that it would happen. Institutions, and this is where, you know, the to some extent, Republicans and libertarians are right, that you know, institutions are very resistant to their own dissolution. Particularly institutions in government, and so you know, if instead of dissolving them, we could change their mission and put them rather than under law enforcement, put them under the Centers for Disease Control, and make their mission to heal people rather than imprison people.
Yeah, but Tom, here in Illinois, they shut down the Supermax prison at TAMS. They just locked it up. It's in mothballs right now. Why can't we do that with the DEA? I don't understand why they have so much power. Think about it. Yeah. You got a double whammy here. We're creating malnutrition, which causes desperate people to do desperate things, and on the other end, we're depriving people of drug treatment and drugs that causes them to go out on the streets and do desperate things and criminal things. And at the same time, we're financing these drug cartels. It's like it's just violence in every direction.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And in an ideal world, we would just say, okay, that's it. Let's just walk away from the entire war on drugs. And anybody who makes their living on the war on drugs, let's come up with a program for them to do something else. And I guess that's where I was trying to get at is that this is probably a half a trillion dollar industry a year in the United States, the war on drugs. And that's not going to go away real fast. It's going to change and morph, but it's on the other hand, you know, Colorado just said screw it, and so did Washington State. And there's a lot to be said for that. So probably my waffling here on half measures is just mealy mouth waffling, and I should just endorse what you're suggesting, Mike.
Well, so, I don't know, Tom.
Find a politician who will do that. I can find you politicians who will say we should treat the problem of drugs as a medical problem and we should aggressively intervene. But yeah. I can't find politicians who will say we should just walk away from this, decriminalize everything, and as Portugal has done. Well, actually, they said it's a problem of medicine, too, but they already had a national health care system.
It just seems like the argument's on our side. I mean, it's so easy to argue against them. If they say, we can't have drugs. And I say, well, we got alcohol and tobacco, and they're the two major killer drugs.
Right.
I mean, it just seems like the argument, you could shout them down, not shout them down, but just in the arena of ideas, you could put them down every time.
No, I think you're right. And that's why from libertarians to liberals, you find people generally agree with this. And the majority of Americans want to decriminalize, at the very least, marijuana. And like I've said many times, I think anything that you can grow should not, you know, should be decriminalized. I'm with you, Mike. I'm with you. And thank you for the call. Kathy in Valparaiso, Indiana. Hey, Kathy.
Hi, how you doing, Mr. Hartman?
I am well.
I called today because I keep hearing you talk about Reaganomics.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to tell you my story, if you didn't mind.
Sure.
I graduated high school in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated midterm, had my daughter right after I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was pregnant also.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved away from the area. She got welfare. I went to work a minimum wage job. I worked that job for 7.5 years. In the meantime, her caseworker was telling me what I could do and what I couldn't do. And I said, listen, I'm not on welfare. She is. We live in the same house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he says, it's like a pie. You put all your money together and you cut it down in half. And my mom said to him, how come your half, my half, can have food stamps and Medicaid, but Kathy's half can't? Do you get what I'm saying?
Yep.
I worked. I put myself through college. I told that caseworker, I said, someday I will be down there working, and I don't want your job. I'll be your boss. The day I started working there, I ran smack dab into him. He ended up quitting and becoming an insurance agent.
Really? You went to work at the welfare agency?
Lake County Welfare Department.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's why I call you all the time, because what you're talking about is like my life.
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
While I was working there, I had to fight the system in another county.
Uh-huh.
Ended up in jail in 1992 for contempt. I had lost all of my constitutional rights.
Whoa.
I was told, because I talked too much, I said, no, I stood up for my values. I stood up for what I believed in. And my attorney says, the problem was, you thought you could change the system by working there, and they thought they could change you.
Right.
And then neither one of you were going to ever get together.
Right.
So when I had my car accident, they made sure they made my life a living hell to get me to quit. I had a perfect 10-year record with the state of Indiana and Child Protection Service.
Wow.
I'm disabled now. And now I'm told, go get a job and do this and do that.
Right.
I would love to mentally do that. But what do I do instead? I try to take things to the food pantries, help people who are off in worse off position than I am now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that's ingrained in me to do, to pay it forward. That's all what I've always believed in. But what I called about the Reaganomics in this, in the town I live in the county I live in a Republican state, I feel like an alien because it has been so hard for me to find shelters, food pantry. You wouldn't believe what I've had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I'm like, there are poor people here, but they don't want the community to know about it.
Yeah. Yeah,
you want to keep it hidden.
Yeah, it's the Giuliani effect. I remember when after Giuliani became mayor in New York, walking down the street in New York City and watching a cop beat up a guy who was sitting on the street with a cardboard sign, you know, saying, please give me money. I'm homeless. And basically, Giuliani got all the homeless people, you know, they vanished from the streets of Manhattan. They popped up in Brooklyn and Queens, and you know, but they vanished from Manhattan. And it's like, that's not the way to do it. You don't do it by beating people up and kicking them out of town. You do it by lifting people up.
And now it's happening to everybody, and everybody's looking at me like, well, how did you do it?
Right.
And I'm still having to fight every day for what I believe in. But what the point was, in this Republican state, they always brag about this rainy day fund they have
mm-hmm.
at the governor's office.
Right.
But we have all this poverty. We have these children that are sick.
Right. It's raining.
It's pouring. It's thunderstorming, and they're bragging about how much money they're saving.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
now,
you know, you do have a Republican governor there in Indiana.
You have sent me back to school. I go to the library, and I have gotten more books, and I've been ranting and raving to everybody about the book that you told, Original Wisdom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Robert Wolf. Isn't that a brilliant book? Kathy, I got to go, but thank you so much for the call, and great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with the last quarter of the hour. I'm thinking Danielle is magic here. It's amazing stuff going on here in the studio. And then all of a sudden it changes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to say the last caller, I mean, you know, you have some of the most wonderful callers because, you know, she really lived through, you know, the results of Reaganomics. And, you know, she just has a testament to say to the rest of us, but, it, you know, her call pales for mine. But I just want to say that I agree with Alan that the time for the Democratic Party is past, and they had their chance. They've, you know, constantly screw us over. And I was at the gym today, and sure enough, Barbara Bush is up on MSN saying how she just absolutely loves the Clintons, right, and how, you know, they're all in so tight together. Well, you know, Bill Clinton was the best thing that ever happened to the Republican Party. He furthered their policies on steroids, NAFTA, SHAFTA, and now we
have... I know, and he's worth $80 million now.
Yeah, and you know what? I say, you know, I can't say it. If I saw him in the street, I'd say, you creep. I mean, in some other explicit.
Yeah, things you can't say on the radio. Yeah.
Yeah,
thank you for not doing that.
Say on the radio. Yeah. But my point is that I agree with Alan. I think, you know, what happened with Roosevelt, he was pushed by the left. And,
oh, I know.
And, you know.
So how do we do that today? What's your prescription, John?
I think that there is a growing movement. I've been told, now, maybe they're lying to me because they want me to get me to join, but I went to a socialist alternative meeting, and we also almost won a city election here, lost by 230 votes. The lady in Seattle, Sawant, won by, you know, just a hair, but she still won. Despite all of the money against her, on a shoestring, she won. And people love her. I mean, it's just amazing. You don't see more of it in the news.
No, I've had her on the show twice in the last 3 weeks.
And, you know, it's wonderful. And a lot of young people, that socialism is not a dirty word. And so, you know, maybe that's where we need to work to really change the system. I agree we need to change the legal system. You had a person on, you know, move to amend.org. I mean, he's very impassioned about that issue, and that can help. But also, you know, the structure of the economy needs to change. We are left out of it.
Right.
The middle class, they are shrinking our jobs, shrinking our livelihoods, and they're screwing us over. And, you know, the Democratic Party just goes ahead and goes along with it.
In many cases, not in all cases. I can make an argument that having third parties pushes a party, and history would support that. And I can also make an argument that having a third party destroys the party closest to them, or at least hurts them over the short term and defeats their own purpose. And I can, you know, I could cite history for that too. So I'm really kind of ambivalent about it, John. It seems like the best of both worlds would be to be, you know, active in the Green Party or in the Socialist Alternative Party and in the Democratic Party, and bring those values into the Democratic Party. And I think that, frankly, that's what was going on back in the 1930s. My grandfather was a socialist. He was a socialist back when the word socialism meant something very close to communism. And he brought those values into the Democratic Party. Or just super left values. The Soviet experiment really hadn't played out. So, you know, we've run out of time. John, thank you. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and Ellen in Clearwater, Florida. Hey, Ellen. Global reset? Ellen? No, Ellen. Okay. Don.
Hello.
Spokane, Washington. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, sir. Great fan.
Thank you.
Hey, don't follow the money, follow the bankers.
Okay.
But the bottom line is the gentleman that used to be the head of the Israeli bank for 4 or 5 years got that position because he pushed through the law previously in Washington, D.C. that guaranteed that we pay Israel $3 billion a year, no matter what. We're stuck with that until we change the law.
Well, that came out of Camp David, didn't it? Wasn't that the deal that Jimmy Carter negotiated, that if Israel and Egypt would recognize each other and have a peace treaty, that we would give them each roughly $3 billion a year as foreign aid?
Well,
that's my recollection.
As you recall, Egypt, we can stop anytime we want.
Well, I think we could with Israel too. It's just unlikely it would happen. I mean, you know, they're
well, it's not going to happen. And
Israel's a much closer ally. We have, you know, there's an enormous interconnection between the Israeli economy and the American economy that doesn't exist between the U.S. economy and the Egyptian economy. There's more political interpenetration, collaboration, whatever.
Well, we do.
I think you can acknowledge all that without going off Jewish conspiracy theory stuff.
Our problem, sir, is Voltaire said, if you want to find out who runs a society, find out who can't be criticized. How many people have been destroyed? And now we find out this particular television and movie producer was doing that for 30 years.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The gentleman that just announced that he was actually an agent for the Israelis.
I'm sorry, Don.
He was a television producer. Tom, you're going to have to get educated.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to have to. I'll take a look, but I have no idea what you're talking about. Sasha in Los Angeles, listening on KPFK. Hey, Sasha, what's up?
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Tom, I've been enjoying hearing your show for a couple of years, and it's the first time I've called in.
Thank you.
I've been a volunteer organizer activist with the Green Party since its inception in California for over 20 years.
Wow.
And we were the first to endorse the current initiative called California Cannabis Hemp Initiative,
mm-hmm.
Which is CCHI2014.org. And I think we all agree that the drug war needs to be ended,
mm-hmm.
and the legalizing of cannabis for all uses, personal, commercial, private, medicinal, industrial, is the first step. It's not
yes.
the end. It's
I
not
agree.
The all solution. It's just the big boulder. It's in the way. And we are gathering signatures. We need over 500,000 valid voter signatures in California. And the breaking news is just a couple days ago, we started a new thing, which I think may have never been tried before, where individuals can download the entire petition onto an 8.5 by 11 sheet, which is a good thing because usually it's too big on that legal size paper,
mm-hmm.
and unwieldy. You can sign an individual single entry on the petition, sign it immediately, and send it in immediately.
Oh, that's great. Is there a website, Sasha?
And it is CCHI2014.org. And we need volunteers. We need donations all sizes, a dollar.
Right. Okay, it's CCHI as in California Cannabis Hemp Initiative. Is that what it is?
That's correct. And if we have
2014.org.
donating like $5 each, this thing would go right over the top.
Okay.
We have less than a month to get all the qualifying signatures.
Okay, well, let's plug it one more time on the radio then. It's CCHI2014.org is the website.
Yes, sir. And even if you're not a California voter, you can donate any amount of money, large or small, will help.
Okay. And Sasha, I got to move along, but I hope the plug works. Let me know. If you get any feedback. Van in Los Alamitos, California, also listening on KPFK. Hey, Van, what's up?
Well, I have a question to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
Since the Supreme Court has rendered the corporation as a person,
right?
Would it not follow that as a person they are subject to the alternative minimum tax?
You would hope so, but unfortunately they have, you know, the Supreme Court has not really said that they're persons. They, you know, they've used this convoluted logic. So corporations still have the benefits of being a corporation. Plus they get to mess with their constitutional rights. So you make that perfect logical argument, but, unfortunately you can't unpack it. Thanks for the call though. It amplifies why we need to roll back this, why we need this constitutional amendment. Jeremiah, listen to WBAI in Jersey City. Hey, Jeremiah.
Hey, pleasure to talk with you, Tom. I think you're a really outstanding host and I really enjoy your program.
Thank you. We have just 1 minute left until the end of the show.
Okay, I want to say I'm really worried about what I call the Tony Soprano effect, which is sort of this attitude that, you know, you can have somebody, you know, getting bled in the bathtub, in the bathroom while you eat your spaghetti and meatballs in the next room.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is the invasion of Libya, for example, was an out-and-out war crime.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand this sort of mainstreaming of this stuff that, oh, you got the wacky Republicans.
Well, I think we stopped we stopped this in Syria, you know, or at least so far. I mean, there's some good news there is that, you know, Americans saw what happened with Iraq and Afghanistan, both under Bush and Obama, and they're saying enough already.
Right, but I mean, what about, for example, the people of Libya? Like, these crimes have been committed.
It's ongoing. It's ongoing.
Right,
Libya is a disaster area right now.
I think even from the progressive community, from even outspoken people such as yourself, I don't think the indignation is sufficient. Like, these are major, major crimes.
Yeah.
It's not like...
Okay, Jeremiah, I'm with you. I'd like to add that when George Bush lied us into that region, into conflict in that region, he opened the gates of hell. And, you know, like Tony Blair got citizen arrested yesterday. You know, we should be talking about accountability for these things. Jeremiah, thanks for the call. And thanks for listening to WBAI. I guess that's wrapping up the show, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, occupy something, right? Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. Angie'sList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at Angie'sList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.